This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello and welcome to our bonus Q&A episode of Books of the Year. We're in the studio here with Tom Burgess, whose book is Cuckoo Land, Where the Rich Own the Truth. You can hear, if you've missed that, you can go back and listen to that. And then a lot of what you're about to hear might make sense. By the way, I was going to make, because you work for the FT, and the FT review, they describe...
Oh, well, I used to, yeah.
Yeah, you used to work for the FT, now you work for the Guardian. But the FT, amongst them, this book has been universally praised. They said, pacey and sordid.
You want that? Yeah,
sort of people go, actually.
Yeah, well, like any article in the FT.
I'll put that there, pacey and sordid. I'll put it on the front. Okay, so this is our Q&A. So, Tom Burgess, what is the last book that you really, really enjoyed reading?
The Fraud, the latest Eddie Smith. I loved it.
Okay, tell us more.
I've always loved Eddie Smith, but I'm also obsessed with this whole idea of can the rich own the truth? Or more broadly, who decides what's real? Because our sort of systems for doing that seem to have completely broken down. So we're all standing at what used to be the public square screaming at each other. And the craft, the novelist's craft of that novel is magnificent. And as ever, she, and I think you can see this developing with Zadie Smith's books, one after another, is she hones this kind of like wry, kind of Austinish voice where no one's ever quite let off the hook. And at the heart of it is this question of this guy's turned up. He claims to be the heir to a massive fortune in Victorian England, but he is obviously... totally bogus. It's just rubbish. The whole thing is evidently rubbish. And yet, there are huge screaming crowds saying, believe him, believe him. Mm. And there's a real sort of class and religious element to this. And I wouldn't claim to be able to sort of fillet the novel entirely. But for me, it gets across how we believe what we think it's in our interest to believe, or what we think what will benefit people like us. And you walk down that road long enough, you come up with this sort of terrifying idea that the truth is so fragile. And the other thing that she does so brilliantly, and I hope I've done a little managed to do a little bit of this in Cuckoo Land, is demonstrate how hilarious it is when people try to insist on ludicrous version of realities and really, really insist on it and draw all sorts of levers to try and make that the case and try to say that this chicken over here is really a dinosaur. And it just becomes hysterically funny. I mean, from the opening page onwards, The Fraud is just compellingly hilarious.
We're big fans of libraries on this podcast. So how often do you visit libraries, and when you do and you take books out, do you take books out? Do you just go there to do your research and sort of leave the books there? Or when you take them out, do you take them out for pleasure? Do you take them out for research? What?
I take the kids. And for myself, I go for research, but I also buy too many. Because I like to scribble over them. and like break the back and go back, and we'll find, you know, that on, in the margin of one page is something that's crucial to this bit of the book or that bit of the book. But I'm with you on loving them.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law was a librarian, and she hated the fact that I wrote in books. Because I do the same. If you bought a paperback for six quid or something, you know, and it's going to be underline. It's what I did. You do it at university.
In your book. Yeah, fine.
Don't underline someone else's book.
No.
Well, this. Yeah.
But it was just taking a pen and marking.
Oh, the very act of the marking act a book
is desecration.
Right. Okay.
Oh, no, I love the idea of the reader marking the book, grappling with it, interrogating it, forming the meaning of it. Yeah.
Exactly. When you are investigating a person or a story, is it always obvious when it's time to stop and publish and step away? Because sometimes it's not obvious, you just want to keep going.
It's obvious because you have run out of money.
That's a very, very good reason.
You run out of time quite a long time ago, generally. So you run out of the extra time and the extra time. And I think, you know, you hear painters say this, don't you? You never finish a painting, you just stop fiddling with it. And that the Cuckoo Land went through some absolutely appalling drafts. I'm lucky enough to have worked with publishers now who understand that it's not, you don't need to completely panic instantly when the, you know, draft three is even worse than draft two. But it does tend to hit a moment when the structure clicks and you think, okay, I have got this now. With one of my previous books, that happened 6 months after it was published, which was disappointing. But with this one, I did really feel like I'd got the structure.
But you need a conclusion, or maybe you don't.
I think that you do, actually. I think this is the first time I've written a book that has works as a whole. And I think that's part of the tricky thing in being a journalist who writes books, is that the two crafts might seem similar, but wildly different. And so you do need something that sits satisfyingly as an ending, but stories actually don't really end, do they?
Well, some do.
Do they?
Yes, I think so. Satisfying ones do, I think.
Yeah, I suppose, is our need for that satisfaction really honest? In that, does it really chime with how the world works?
Yeah, well, if you read, I mean, I'm sure people who read detective fiction, one of the reasons, I did actually interview P.D. James about this many years ago, and she said the reason why people enjoy these books is because it presents an ordered world where there is a conclusion and the person who did it cops it and goes to prison.
I'm totally fascinated by this. There's that idea of that yearning for order in a world that I think increasingly is saying, you sure I really work like that? Mm. It is such a need, isn't it? Such a yearning that we all have. There's, I think it's somewhere in, this could be wrong, but I think it's somewhere in Roland Barthes or some one of those French, amazing French thinkers. I mean, hard to get your head around, but some of it's beautiful. About the sound we say a clock makes. Like, we say tick-tock, but it doesn't go tick-tock. It goes tick, 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 tick. So every time we think we're, okay, beginning and ending, beginning and ending, beginning and ending. And actually, everything just came.
My last book was called TikTok.
I'm going to have
to go back. But actually,
I was aware of that. But
doesn't a grandfather? Didn't the old grandfather clock with the long pendulum? Wasn't in my head. It's a click at one side, and then it's a different sound on it.
I think.
Yeah, it's the same.
I think you. I'm not. I think that's how I would imagine it too. But I did think there was something really arresting in that piece of writing that said, hang on a second, are we just seeing beginnings and endings everywhere?
Yeah,
and my God, we need it. We need to. And it's a deep yearning. But actually, maybe everything just carries on regardless.
Yeah, maybe.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Can you read anywhere when you're delving into your French philosophers? Can you read anywhere, or do you have a favourite place to read?
Oh, it tends to be on the go. I think it's years as a correspondent. I quite like a bit of noise to write, and maybe less so to read. My wife's actually just got me a chair for reading in.
Ah.
For my birthday, I was really, really pleased about it. But then again, you know, the chair is in the house with the small children, so yeah. I don't know. I mean, I really like, if I've got something I really want to just sort of sit with, I really love to go to Darwin's house, which is not too far from where we live, down in sort of southeast, to beyond the end of southeast London, and he's got these gardens there. And so there are a few places like that where if there's something you really want to savour, I have a few particular places sort of dotted around London. An airplane's quite good as well, because no one can reach you.
Is there a story that you've read about or come across that you thought, damn, I wish I'd found that?
Practically every time I open a newspaper. But I think that professional jealousy is quite a good thing, because it spurs you on to try and find one of your own. But what would be a good example? I think everything Patrick Radden Keefe ever writes, for instance.
Yeah.
I have to set that aside. Luckily, he's such a beautiful writer. You think, okay, great. And the fascinating thing with what Patrick does is that a lot of the stories are just sitting there in plain view. I mean, his book about the Sacklers wasn't even the first book about the Sacklers. There were other ones which were also brilliant. But, his previous book, Say Nothing, about the Troubles.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's absolutely magnificent. Yeah. He took one murder that had been pretty well investigated and pretty much solved it.
Mm.
And so on. I think that I've switched something into like books I wish I'd written, but anything Barbara Demick writes as well, her work on sort of North Korea and Tibet. But again, these are stories that are just sitting there. I mean, sometimes you do see an incredible splash that Gabriel Progren at the Sunday Times or whoever it may be the New York Times has nailed down. You think, God, that was absolutely magnificent. And sometimes in the investigative journalism world, you will have got a whiff of something but decided to go after something else because there's only so many hours in the day, and you think, oh, I could have done that. But generally, if I manage to suppress my own insecurities enough, I feel it's tremendous when any good piece of investigative journalism comes out, because it's so hard to do any of it.
If you hadn't been an investigative journalist and writer, what profession might we have found you in that sort of fork in the road, if you'd gone a different way?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously there was a phase where I really wanted to play for Man United.
Oh, right. Okay.
You'd probably get in the team at the moment.
Yeah, I would. Done my leg, though. I've done my leg at Monday Night Football.
You'd still get in the team.
Yeah, I probably would, actually. So is everyone else at United. And then, yes, various other ideas. And then what I really, really wanted to do and try to be was a poet. I really wanted to be. I found all sorts of things in my late teens, including poetry. And really wanted to do that. And I ended up knocking around in Latin America. With a few handful of pesos, and I thought, as the pesos dwindled, I thought, I'll just do what Samuel Beckett did, which was just when money gets short, just occasionally win an extremely prestigious poetry prize.
Easy.
And you've got the internet these days, so you can just literally email it in from the La Paz cyber cafe. This would have been, this is like 20 years ago. And I had by then like a couple of poems published in unbelievably obscure like poetry magazines read by people in single numbers of.
Isn't that true of pretty much most poetry magazines, would you say?
I fear it is. Yes, increasingly, maybe not once, but anyway, So I knocked out my entry for whatever it was, the British Poetry Prize, $5,000, which would have lasted me for months. Sent it off, and you may be surprised to learn that I was not the 2004 laureate, whatever it was. And actually, shortly out of that, I ran out of money to such an extent that I got a job on a little newspaper in Santiago, in Chile, and they let me live in their shed. And I was doing art stuff. And then the reckoning with Pinochet started. And the anti-globalisation movement was in full throat, full cry. There was a big environmental scandal. It was an extraordinary time, actually, in this amazing country. And suddenly it's like, yeah, maybe I should stop maybe I should just at least briefly to try and help outdo the news, opposed to just another 3,000 words on the Cartier-Bresson exhibition. And brilliant though that was. And that was it. And also, you know, I wasn't good enough at poetry. So.
We'll do poetry for money. Oh, yeah. Good luck.
What is there a genre of book that you would read for pleasure?
Oh, well.
You're at the airport. You've had it. You don't want to, you know, you're being sued, legal cases, but they're all sorted. You're fine. But you just want something to relax.
It's interesting that. I mean, there's obviously the latest Mayo.
Obviously.
Yeah. Tick, tick. Damn.
I grapple with this. So at the moment I'm reading, just read, Naomi Klein's new one, Doppelganger, which I think is also fantastic. And again, about this question. It's always the question of, is it possible to find something that's completely removed from all sort of everything I'm investigating, everything I've thought about, every place I've ever been, somewhere that, where you can just kind of just delight in. And I don't think that's necessarily a genre. I increasingly think that's just wonderful writing and storytelling. So for instance, Patrick Rand keep mentioning him, but the any of his are so beautifully written that even though some of them touch on what I'm working on, that is something I can't just got to get engrossed in. You had Ed Caesar on, and what a storyteller he is. And those ones. I mean, recently, what have I picked up that I've just loved? Small Things Like These. Is it Claire Keegan? That short novel about Catholicism in Ireland was beautiful. Anything by Laurent Binet in France, who wrote an amazing novel about the assassination of Heydrich, that's called HHHH.
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah, I read that. Yeah.
Like, and his later ones, actually. There's one called The Seventh Function of Language, which is completely mind-blowing. But the most recent one, I think it's the most recent one, Civilizations, which just flips on its head. And what if Latin American civilizations had conquered Europe? It's completely mind-blowing. Yeah, Zadie Smith. If I really need something that I know I'll just love, it would be a Martin Amis novel.
Of the many, many countries that you've visited and reported on, is there one country that you'd love to go back to, given the chance?
I think I'll always be entwined with Nigeria. I lived there for a while, for a couple of years, but more. And that is a place where the stakes and everything are so high. Enormous country. Like, a lot of the future, in one way or another, looks like Nigeria, for good and ill. I think I talked about Chile. I'm still very attached to that. There's lots of little parts of Africa. When I was I was really keen to go back to Russia, but since what's happened to Evan, who's in jail, like, that's very, very hard to do. I want to go back to Ukraine soon. I think this summer in Ukraine, followed by the American election, like, the fate of free societies hangs on those things. When I'm away somewhere that's, you know, quite demanding, I dream of the Lake District. And like that, when I was living away, especially, that would be that's a place of great kind of peace for me.
Finally, you are throwing a fantasy dinner party.
Ah.
You can invite three authors, living or dead. Who's coming?
Excluding those in this room.
Obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. Three authors, living or dead. Mandela.
Okay, bit of a cheat, but yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Well, but I'll justify that. I say him because I once climbed up, when I was a correspondent in Johannesburg for a while, and I climbed up a fence once at an ANC rally in Pretoria, and I met his eyes, and it was absolutely electrifying. And I think, obviously there's lots of reasons to have Mandela for dinner, but the Long Walk to Freedom is a literary masterpiece in its own right. It's the most magnificent piece of writing, thrillingly gripping. I think a lot of people think, oh, 700 pages of worthiness, that will be. No, it's like, it's a magnificent literary achievement, that, of political thought and autobiography, but also just the most amazing, the most amazing historical story.
Okay, Nelson Mandela's one. He's going to dominate, isn't he? Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think I'm going. So you know, would not. I love Amis, and he normally goes with the hits, right? So you'd have Christopher Hitchens and Amis, but that's obviously two people. So I'm not sure I can have both. I think I might get Amis along. He's just very, very funny. I met him a couple of times, and I think that for all, there's all sorts of criticism of him. But I think that he is someone who is just relentlessly honest. And I think posterity, especially now you get the Zone of Interest being made into that remarkable film, I think posterity is elevating Amis. And that's pleasing to see. And I think I would chuck in Zadie then, Smith.
Okay.
Mates with Martin Amis when he's alive. And the dynamic of those who would be absolutely amazing.
So Zadie Smith, Martin Amis, Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
I think the good news there is that the other two would have no compunction in telling Nelson, enough now, we all need to talk. You've talked about Robben Island enough, Nelson. Time for the rest of us to have a go.
Yeah, but the other thing, those three are, they're all hilarious. It's forgotten how funny Mandela was. I mean, when he was... as I remember this story, is that when he got to the UK for the first time after he got released, his opening line at the press conference was, well, actually, all these years in Robben Island has prepared me for your hotel rooms. and, like, I think, actually, in these serious times, humour, really well-used and well-thought-through humour, is crucially important.
Donald Trump likened himself to Mandela at the weekend.
Yeah, well, that's really funny.
Yeah, that's very funny. Tom Burgess's book is Cuckoo Land, Where the Rich Own the Truth. You can find Tom talking about that on our previous podcast. But Tom, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, a real pleasure. Thanks for having
me. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.